Good morning. How is the greatest listening audience in the history of listening audiences? Does that sound pretty good? Complimentary? I'm just kind of messing with you. It's kind of what my Uncle Joe Lawson, he was from Bristol, Tennessee, and he had a company called Sesco Management Consultants. And if you live in Bristol and you've been alive for a pretty long time, you probably remember Uncle Joe. He was always my uncle. He was my, I guess, great uncle, right? My grandfather's brother. He would always greet me the same way. He would say, "How's my favorite grandnephew?" You know, and that just made me feel good because I really looked up to him. He was a wild game hunter. He really, in addition to all his business interests, and some people may be greatly offended by that, but he was had a lot of world records and would travel all over the world and shoot gazelles and lions and stuff like that. I don't know if that's fashionable anymore, but it was back in his era. When I was in the sixth grade, I lived in St. Albans, West Virginia, and invited him to come to my elementary school and do a slideshow of he and my Aunt Marguerite doing their thing in Kenya or Africa somewhere. And oh my, I was like the hit of the class after that was over. You may recall the Hands-On Museum here in Johnson City, and they had this thing called Noah's Ark. Well, all of the heads of all of those animals and the big bears standing on their hind legs and so forth, those were all donated by Uncle Joe Lawson, and he provided all those to them at no charge. So he was quite the businessman, and my dad's first job out of the Navy was working for Uncle Joe in Princeton, West Virginia. Uncle Joe was at one time the mayor of Princeton, and he got involved in labor relations, and he was always on the side of the companies. He would help companies negotiate with labor unions and stuff, and primarily in the coal industry, but in a lot of other industries as well. But he was quite the character, and anybody that knows him would say the same. You know, knew him. There are many people that just simply have the ability to make others feel good just by being in their presence. It is, it's not that they are, tremendously handsome or beautiful or they don't talk the most. It's just that what they say, sometimes people think that it's worth listening to. And, they also know how to make people feel comfortable. I think chivalry, if it's not dead, it's dying. I think when I see these young couples going into a restaurant and I see the guy just barging right into the door first without opening the door for the lady, I think that's still offensive to me. I see the eating habits. My wife probably wouldn't want me to bring this up, but she says it may not be any of my business, but eating habits are atrocious right now. And why is that important? You know, why is it important how people eat, how people dress, how people behave in the business world and so forth? Do you think it's important? Or do you think it's just something from the past that we don't need to think about anymore? I think it's important. I think it's chivalry, just being some people are actually offended by somebody being opening the doors for them. You know, some lady say, "I'm going to open up my own door. You know, I don't need you to open my door for me." They feel like they're being insulted. People today get insulted really easily, seems like. They're just like the anger is just right there. They're just waiting for you to knock that chip off their shoulder. And that's just no way to be. We just all have to be able to be cordial, polite, respectful, slow to anger. Those kind of things, serve us well in business. I used to have somewhat of a chip on my shoulder when somebody, like when I was a service advisor in the dealership and somebody come in and they were just mad, you know, because their car had broken down and they were taking it all out on me, you know, and I said, "Well, I didn't break your car, you know." But they're just mad at their situation, and it took me a while to understand that. I don't know that everybody is suited to be in a customer-facing position. Do you? I think there's some people that would be better off just, you know, being on the assembly line or doing something where they don't have to interact with others. And a lot of people would admit to that. And there's not, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with that. I'm just saying that people have different skill sets. Or really, I don't know if it's skill sets or just attributes. You know, it's just the way they look at the world and the way they behave, the things that they do. Some people are just more comfortable with strangers. Would you agree with that? Some people are have the ability to talk to a stranger, or other people just, you know, they'll walk right past you. There's just two of you on a sidewalk, and they'll walk right past you without looking at you and saying, "Hi, how are you today?" You know, that's just always been my nature, to greet people, to not. I mean, I'm in Greene County. When we moved here, it was just like up in West Virginia. When somebody passes you on a two-lane road, you wave at them. You know, that's just something that that we always did, and I still do. I don't do it all the time. You know, it depends on how distracted I am, but I do it a lot. And I just think that that's just a carryover, a vestige. Is that the right word? Of my past. And that's the way my parents, you know, my dad was a manners guy. My mom was, or sometimes she would say, "Max, leave him alone." You know, but most of the time she was on the same page as he was. But, you know, let's do what we can to solidify some values and some good attributes in our kids and grandkids. And you know, I guess there's not enough talking going on between the old folks and the young these days. The chasm has grown, and we have so much to learn from people who are retired and worked very busy lives. It's amazing how many people I run into at the dealership. I mean, they ran big companies. I mean, massive companies, and they are, you know, very influential. They used to be speakers. They were college professors and stuff, and they just come in. They got a T-shirt on and, you know, blue jeans. They're just getting their car serviced. They're retired. And, you know, sometimes they just kind of fade into the background. And sometimes I think I wish those people would be more assertive and not think that their opinions don't matter, because they do. And a lot of us younger folks need to hear them. So anyway, that's my whatever you want to call it, editorial comments. And I'll be back here in just a minute. Okay, I am back. You know, I've talked about this before. That occasionally there will be a phone call or a in-person visit of somebody that wants to buy my dealership. You know, I got one of those calls 2 days ago from another dealer who said, you know, and they do it. They normally approach it in a very nice way. And they say, "Lenny, you know, how are things going and all this stuff?" And it's small talk. He says, "Have you ever thought about selling your dealership?" And I said, "Well, there were times that I have. I mean, at one time I was involved and owned a large part of five different dealerships, and I realized that's not what I wanted to do. I was not a corporate kind of guy. I hated meetings. I did not like, you know, just the kind of effort and the politics and stuff that you have to go through when you have that many, five different cultures, you know, that you have to deal with. And it just was not fun for me. Now, some people really do well in that environment. I'd rather just have one. And so that's what I do. And, you know, this is where I plan on carrying on, and I've got family in the business. So I politely told him, "No, I'm not really interested, or not at all interested in selling my dealership." And so he understood and was very nice about it. So what do you sell when you sell a dealership? You know, so you think, a lot of people think that, well, if it says Ford outside, that Ford owns the dealership and I just run it. Well, that's not how it works. The dealership model in the United States is a franchise model. It's just like Chick-fil-A or McDonald's or something like that. Now, you will see that there are McDonald's corporate stores. You know, they're owned by the McDonald's Corporation. But I think the vast majority of McDonald's operations are privately owned. And many of those owners have multiple locations. And there are a lot of food companies that have, basically you have a central office, and then they own a bunch of different restaurants, hundreds of restaurants of many different names. But if you're a Ford dealer, let's just use Ford as the example here, then you approach Ford Motor Company and you tell them that you want to be a new car dealer, and they put you through this vetting process, which involves looking at your financial situation, your work history, your experience. You can pretty much count on the fact that it doesn't matter how much money you have, if you have no experience in the car business, they will not grant you a franchise. Now, the franchise is free. Yeah, it's not like buying a Chick-fil-A or something like that where you have to pay a bunch of money up front to buy the franchise. General Motors, Toyota, Nissan, none of them charge for the franchise. What they do charge is for the inventory and for all of the capitalization that is required to start your business. Most car dealerships are corporations, either they're either a C corporation, an S corporation, or it could be an LLC. Ford would not allow you to run your dealership as an LLC. They're either C or S corporations. And that's just how the government looks at your corporation. A C corporation is taxed differently. An S corporation has a limited number of shareholders, and you're taxed once. When the earnings are when you have a bottom line, then you pay federal tax on that bottom line on your basically your personal return. Whereas if you're a C corporation, the corporation pays tax, and then the owners of the corporation get dividends, and then they have to pay tax on the dividends too. So a lot of people think S corporations are the way to set up a car dealership, and I tend to agree. So when you sell a dealership, you're selling one of two things, two different ways you can sell one or buy one, is you can sell the corporation itself, which owns all the assets of the corporation, or you can sell just the assets themselves. But either way, the individual that's buying the dealership has to be approved by the manufacturer, or it ain't happening, okay? The factory has the final say on who their dealer is. And, you know, sometimes dealers have partners. I've been in situations where I had up to three partners in a dealership. And I like it better when I have no partners. They always say that when you have a partner, you're happy that you have a partner when times are bad. And you're not happy when you have a partner when times are good, because you have to split everything with them. Now, that's not always true. When I bought this Ford dealership in 2005, I had partners, and now I don't. There was a Great Recession. You remember that one? That was around 2008, 2009. It was rough, and barely didn't survive that financially. But anyway, it was a challenge that forced us basically to divide up our empire into different pieces, and we were able to all survive it. And I mean, it was not easy. It was a lot of meetings, a lot of prayer, a lot of worrying, and getting up at 2 a.m. and not being able to go back to bed. And you know, everybody tries to portray this life that on Facebook or wherever, that you know, we're the best, we're the greatest. I didn't feel like I was the best or the greatest at that time, at that particular point in my life. And but we were able to get out of that, and now you know, business is really good. Our biggest constraint right now is just the availability of product. But I wouldn't plan on selling my dealership under any circumstance right now. Well, I guess there's probably one or two, but when I bought the Ford dealership, it was a corporation. I felt really good about the previous owner, so we just bought his corporation. Most of the time, you don't do that. Most car dealers don't want to buy somebody's corporation because there are liabilities that may go along with that corporation. For example, if there is a lawsuit that comes up that where they are suing you, but a vehicle they bought 5 years ago, what if you bought the corporation? That entity is what's being sued. And so you would be stuck with that lawsuit, even though, you know, you weren't even there when it occurred. That's why a lot of them buy the assets of the corporation. Now, what are those? Well, that's, you know, the inventory is part of it, but usually that's on borrowed money. That's a floor plan. Usually you're just buying tools and equipment and furniture and fixtures and parts. Sometimes you buy the building, but most of the time in car dealerships, the corporation does not own the building. Normally that's owned individually by the dealer himself, like I own my building, for example. Most dealers do keep those two things separate, but some don't. You know, some actually roll it all into one, but not many. So when you sell your dealership, like I say, you can either sell your corporation or your assets. Now, what brought this up with me was I was looking at the automotive news, and they were just talking about how many dealerships are up for sale right now and how many are swapping hands. There's a lot of capital out there, a lot of public corporations, publicly traded companies like Lithia. You may never heard of them. AutoNation, Sonic Automotive, you know, Bruton Smith. He's the guy that owns Bristol Motor Speedway and many other things. His company is out there buying, gobbling up car dealers that are for sale because they've been very profitable and they have all this capital and they think they can replicate that. Now, typically you'll see the dealerships in the larger communities like in Johnson City, Bristol, Kingsport, those will bring a lot more money than a car dealership in Greenville will. Or in Newport or someplace like that. The larger the market, then the more valuable the store is. At one time, they used to price dealerships based on multiples of earnings. So if a dealership was making, you know, $1 million a year or whatever, then they would pay like two or three times earnings for the store. But now it's different. They're buying potential. You know, they're buying a rooftop and a place where, you know, they don't necessarily care what the other dealer has done because they're going to do a whole lot better, you know, because of their systems and processes and stuff. So it's just kind of interesting when somebody calls you and say, hey, would you be interested in selling your business? That just thought doesn't run through my mind very often, and it kind of shocks me every now and then. But my decision is real easy. I mean, I've got my two girls here, my nephew, my son-in-law. You know, we live here, we work here, we love our community, we take care of our customers. We're a part of East Tennessee and our customer base. I have no idea how many cars we've sold over the years, but I would say it's in the hundreds of thousands since 1971. This is our, from a family standpoint, this is our 50th year in the car business. We started in August of 1971, and we're still going. We're like the Energizer Bunny, and we're just going to keep doing it until somebody runs us off, and hopefully that won't happen anytime soon. But we'll be back in just a minute. Hey, folks, we don't want China to take over Taiwan. I hope that doesn't happen. Taiwan is our friend. They're doing everything they can to address this global shortage of semiconductors. Those are the chips that we can't get. And that's what's keeping the parking lots up in Michigan and Louisville, Kentucky, and everywhere else there's an auto assembly plant. That's what's keeping those lots full because they can't make enough chips. And when they do make them, they come in and they start releasing some of these vehicles. I've got one in the showroom right now. It's an F-150, one of the hybrid F-150s. And I was just standing beside the bed, and I was looking into it, and this one has one of those spray-in bed liners. And I could look at the along the just under the lip of the edge of, you know, the top rail of the bed, and I could notice how shiny the spray-in bed liner material was. But when I looked at the bed itself, it's not faded out, but it's the shine is gone. And I showed it to Ben, my son-in-law, who's my Ford sales manager, and I said, you know why that is? He said, yeah, it's been sitting in a parking lot for 6 months. And that's what has happened. I mean, these vehicles are partially completed, mostly completed. They put the ECM in the car. They drive it out into the parking lot. They unplug the ECM, take it in, bring in another vehicle back and park it. So they will not run as long as they're in that parking lot and don't have the main computer hooked up to it. But this is what the industry is going through right now, and that's why I talked to a dealer the other day, and it was Ted Russell Ford on Parkside Drive in Knoxville. They have four new Fords in stock, folks. Four. They would normally have 250, probably. So, you know, this is having a major impact. We did get a new Bronco in the other day, and this one we can sell. Yeah. You know, most of the Broncos were sold with reservations. We petitioned for an additional unit. We got it. And unfortunately, we can sell it. It has to be sold to somebody who has a reservation or has actually got an order in. So if you are one of those individuals who are out there and you've placed an order for a Ford Bronco, you can come to Gateway and get one, but we only have one. The first 50 Broncos that we get are sold. The first 180,000 approximately that are built are already sold, unless people back out because they've had to wait too long, which is understandable. Ford has sold or has reservations for 100,000 of the new Ford Maverick pickup trucks. I saw one of the Hyundai Santa Cruz pickup trucks. It looks too much like a Subaru Brat to me. I don't think Ford has anything to worry about from that vehicle, but I may be wrong. It may sell well if you want a little truck. I mean, I don't know whether you call it a truck or a crossover with a bed. Now, the Maverick does look like a truck, even though it is a crossover with a bed also. It's just boxy, whereas the Hyundai is swoopy. I mean, are you into boxy or swoopy? I like boxy. That's just me, though. But anyway, folks, it is Friday, and if I can help you in any way at Gateway Ford, come on down to Gateway Nissan. Come down and see us this weekend. If not, call me. My cell phone number is 423-552-2020, and I'll help you with the value of a car or whatever you need me for. I'm here. And let's see. What else? I guess that's it. I'll be back on Monday morning. Pray for Tim Cable and his wife. Tim is, like I said, suffering from COVID and fighting a real intense battle, and hopefully everything will work out for them. But anyway, we'll see you Monday.